Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Rights Radio Self-Help Hour. I'm your host, Dr. Joyce Starr. Rights Radio is brought to you by starpublications.com, that's star with two R's, and by our media site, rightsradio.com, where consumer, homeowner, health, and safe pet care rights have a permanent address. If you have a problem with a condo or HOA board, click right over to starpublications.com and purchase our homeowner's defense kit. If you care about your inalienable and sovereign rights, type rightsradio.com into the URL bar and hit enter. Now listen up and listen in. We're talking today about bank overdrafts. Why are consumers being raked over the coals? My co-host today is Joe Stallard. Joe is the financial guru for Rights Radio. He has over 20 years' experience in the finance world, including investments, insurance, consumer mortgage, and auto finance. And he also runs a number of financial websites. Hello, Joe. Glad to have you on the show.
Hello, Joyce. It's great to be here with you today.
And a very important topic that we're discussing, bank overdraft fees. I hope you can begin by giving us a view of the bigger picture. Why are consumers facing escalating bank overdraft fees, and how does it happen?
Well, Joyce, there are a couple of points behind this, or a couple of reasons behind this that people need to be aware of. When we start talking about bankers and banks, we have to remember it's all about the money. And one of the biggest problems that we see in terms of how consumers really get affected by overdrafts happens in the case of an overdraft occurring that really didn't need to happen. And let me give you a prime example of that. Let's say, for example, that a person has $100 in their bank account, and they go out and write three checks for $5 apiece. And then they write a check for $100. Now, we know that the $100 check is probably not going to clear, and maybe they're hoping that they'll be able to deposit enough funds to cover it before it goes through. But let's present the worst-case scenario. All four checks show up at the bank on the same day. Now, obviously, there's enough money in the account for the three small checks to clear the $5 checks. But the bank doesn't do that. The bank will reprioritize the debits that have come in, and they will place the largest debit first. So now, instead of the poor consumer suffering maybe one overdraft charge, they get hit with four. And once again, it's all about the money.
Is this new, though? Is this something that's been happening over the last year or two as the banking crisis has unfolded, or has this been going on from time immemorial, but now it's more in the spotlight?
I think it's more in the spotlight now. This is a tactic that the banks have used for a long time. One of the motivating reasons behind charging the consumer these overdraft fees, and they tend to be fairly expensive, they can range anywhere from a low of maybe $19 that I've seen some banks charge all the way up to $40, $45 just for a single overdraft. And that can be the overdraft charge on a $2.50 purchase, for example, which is just a little exorbitant. But one of the bank's motivations behind charging these amounts is to use it as a tactic to direct the customers to sign up for the bank's overdraft protection programs. Now, once again, as we deal with banks, it becomes a real simple matter. All you have to do is follow the money. The money always tells the true story. Because once a consumer signs up for bank overdraft protection, let's say, what happens is the bank is going to now honor this check that overdraws the account. But the consumer is still going to be hit with a couple of charges. A lot of banks will charge a flat fee for implementing the overdraft protection, and they like to implement that flat fee each time you use it. And then in addition to that, the bank is, or the customer is paying interest on the overdraft protection amount. And what this does for a lot of people is, for example, a $2.50 overdraft may trigger the overdraft protection service. Well, it's entirely possible that the overdraft protection service is only going to deposit a minimum of, let's say, $100 into the bank account. So now the consumer is going to pay interest on that for the full month, regardless of how soon they pay it back to the bank.
Wait a minute. Stop right there. Let us say that they immediately notice that there was an overdraft. They didn't intend there to be an overdraft, but they notice it. They pay it off the next day. They're going to be charged a month's interest on it?
They can be charged a month. That's not to say that all banks do. But
okay.
If you read very carefully, and this is where consumers are at a real disadvantage, because the disclosure that the banks make in the documents, in other words, the license, the agreement to use the overdraft protection, buried in there are some really onerous clauses sometimes. Now, the bank may tell you, well, we're going to charge you 1.5% for the overdraft protection, which doesn't sound like a lot of money. But when you annualize it, basically you're paying 18%.
And what can the consumer do? What are the possible ways that they can fight these overdraft charges? I mean, I think what we need to understand is that people from time to time need the option of an overdraft charge because perhaps things weren't entirely balanced. And yet it's usury to be charging them 19% plus a flat fee, et cetera, et cetera.
You're exactly right on that point. It is usury to be charged that kind of an interest rate for a short-term loan, which is basically what this boils down to. If a person has a bank account, in a lot of ways, you become subject to the mercy of the bank. The best way to approach this, if it's an isolated incident, or if it's an incident in which the bank maybe has reordered your debits in order to collect a bunch of overdraft fees instead of, say, just one, in a case like that, the best advice I can offer is the consumer needs to talk directly to a person at the bank and express their outrage over what's happened. Now, the banks, although they're very money-oriented, are still very consumer-oriented. They don't like unhappy customers. And typically what will happen is the bank will roll over if you voice your objection loud enough. They may roll back all the overdraft fees. At the same time, they're going to encourage the customer while they're on the phone or if they're in the bank to join in the overdraft protection plan. Now, and that's not a bad thing because, like you said, there are times when things get out of balance and it may be unavoidable and it may be beyond our control. And I can cite you a personal incident that happened to me. It's been several years ago, but this can be a very common occurrence even in today's world. I was working for a particular company at the time, and I was set up to receive direct deposit of my payroll. And on one particular instance, I was scheduled to receive a bonus check from my company. I would only get a little pay stub, basically, sent to me in the mail. And that was my indication that the deposit had been made. I went and I spent money based on the pay stub that they had sent to me. Turned out that the company had failed to deliver the computer tape to their bank to transmit the funds to my bank. So here I was writing checks on non-existent money.
We have a quote here from, just to mention, a quote from the senior counsel with the American Bankers Association, and she says it's not enough to put your account on autopilot and expect banks to be your accountant. She said a major hazard for consumers is the incorrect expectation that transactions are instantly processed. Consumers end up spending more than their account holds because their balances haven't been updated. In your case, it wasn't even deposited. But what happens when it isn't updated?
Well, what happens if we go out and write a check today and then write a check tomorrow? We would anticipate that the check today would go to the bank before the check tomorrow. And that's not always the case. So she makes a valid point there. Sometimes the merchant or the person who's processing the debit or check, as it may be, may not submit it to the bank in a real timely fashion. Now, most businesses want their money and they want it right away. And so as a result, they do submit it to the bank as quickly as possible. But you'll have an occasional instance where it doesn't happen that way, and things can be held up for a matter of days or even weeks before they actually show up at the bank. The fact that she makes the statement that the banks are not your accountant is an old excuse that I hear from bankers all the time. And basically what it does is it tries to throw the blame back onto the consumer when, in fact, most of the spurious and onerous charges that people encounter are not necessarily their fault, but they're due to the banks reordering the debits when they showed up. And the bankers have a tendency to say that's not exactly what happens, but there are too many reports out in the marketplace today that say, yes, that's exactly what happens. And the motivation behind it is so that the bank can collect a little more money. So the bank.
What about
is,
the idea of the bank that doesn't update its account? And here we have, you're talking about people who are putting through checks on your account. But what about the bank? Do the banks always update their accounts in a timely manner? Can you go wrong by expecting that they will do so? Should you be checking your balances every night through the computer? What should a person anticipate here in a worst case?
The banks are not always as prompt as they need to be. And in many instances, most banks have a set policy where their set policy is at the end of the day, they process the transactions for that day. And that includes all the debits and all the deposits that the customers have made. Many banks will process the debits or the checks before they process the deposits. Now, since we're living in the computerized age, what that can do is create an additional problem, because if you've written a check that would normally overdraft your account, but you made a deposit to offset it, but what happens when the bank decides to run the check through before they credit your account with the deposit? Again, you're kind of back to a catch-22 situation in that we're basically at the mercy of the banks for this if this happens. Ideally, a person should have, if they have a computer and they have online access, then they need to sign up for that. And they need to go into their account as often as they're comfortable. And if that means checking it every day, they need to do so. But they need to make sure that things are being done properly in their account. Not only that, but they can occasionally catch something maybe that's not supposed to be there. Because the banks are run by people, and people are prone to mistakes as well. And they do happen, okay? I recall not too long ago when I went to the bank, I made a deposit into my account. And the following morning, I checked my bank account, and they had keyed in the wrong amount of the deposit. What they had done was they had keyed in my account number as being the amount of the deposit.
That's preposterous.
Well, I was suddenly among the 10 wealthiest people in the world for about 2 hours.
That's great. I bet you like that.
There were obviously thoughts running through my head as to, I wonder if I go in and I cash a check now for about $6 million this afternoon.
When you pointed out the error, were they grateful?
No, I didn't have to point out the error. By the end of it, by late that afternoon, I had checked my account in the morning, and I went back that afternoon and checked it. They had found the error, okay,
mm-hmm.
and they had
All
corrected
right.
So they didn't need any help from me on that one. They were real quick.
This is such an important topic, and it brings me to a wider topic, which is the announcement that we made this week, and which I'm very pleased to share with our listeners, that we've joined forces, you and I, to launch something called Rights University and the Rights University Master Courses, which can be found on rightsradio.com. Just look for the navigation bar and you will see the Rights University. And I'm going to give Joe Stallard the stage here to explain what we're trying to achieve with the Rights University and why it might be very important for you. So take it away, Joe.
Thank you, Joyce. What we have done is we have brought together some people that are noted and respected experts in their fields. The whole purpose behind this is to answer people's questions, show them the steps they need to take to reclaim and restore their personal rights, because our rights extend into a lot of different avenues. And what we have right now, we have put together a series of courses, and the initial courses that are up that people can participate in right now that are available are, and let me give you just a quick rundown, and I'll give you just a brief synopsis on each of the different courses we're offering right now. Right now, for the homeowners, for the condo owners, for people who have to deal with homeowners associations, homeowner boards, or condo boards, we've got a couple of really pertinent topics up right now. We've got one that deals with condo board bullies, and the title of the course is Condo Board Bullies and Your Homeowner's Right. The same thing, even though it's called condo board bullies, it also applies to homeowners association boards. And most of the people today, when they buy a condo or a home, whether by choice or by chance, they wind up involved with either a homeowners association or a condo board association. The other course that I feel is real timely has to do with, if you happen to live in a condo, you need to know that you have the guarantee to live in a smoke-free building if you're a non-smoker. And so there's an important course up about the condo association smoke-free rights. This is a particular topic that you'll probably find that the condo board, the condo association is not going to be very sympathetic. They're going to tell you to go away. They're going to tell you you can't do anything. And as a result, this is an important topic for people. In addition to those on the homeowner and condo owner's rights, we've also got some other things up that I know are going to be of real interest to people. We put up a course on cybersecurity rights. Just this past week, it was all over the news about hackers from Russia and China are penetrating into our infrastructure in this country. And this is a very timely course. While the people from China and Russia may not have an interest in getting into my computer or your computer, there are plenty of hackers on the internet who want inside your computer. And they can do some real damage to you. They can steal your identity. They can destroy your computer from the inside out. They can use your computer as a drone, for example, to launch an attack on another website and bring down a website. So there are some pretty serious things at issue here. And most people today really don't understand what they need to do to protect themselves and to protect their computer. So that's an important course. We also have a course up on mortgage and auto loan rights. A lot of people today have been left out of the big mortgage bailout that just took place. We're going to show through this course how they can still save money on their home mortgage, how they can save money on their auto loans, and not go through the hassle of refinancing. We're going to show them how to make their cash work harder. And there's also a real cost of participating in the mortgage bailout that most people aren't aware of. That's another topic that we cover in that course. And probably something that's of great interest to a lot of people, especially with our stock market acting like Chicken Little right now, an important course on shareholder rights. People need to know what their rights are. If you own a stock and it drops like a rock, what can you do? You need to know the precise steps you got to take in order to ever recover any or even the smallest portion of whatever you've invested. And this is a great course. And for this course, we've brought in a litigation specialist, and he specializes in security litigation, Jason Levitin with Berman and DiValerio in Boston. So these are not some small thing that we have put together here, but these are serious, well-thought-out, well-presented courses for people that deal with some serious issues. The great thing about the way we've launched the format on this is people have the opportunity to submit their burning questions related to these topics. In other words, if you're in a particular situation where you're going round and round with your condo association, your homeowners association, and you want to sign up for this course, when you sign up for the course, you get the right to submit a question, and we'll address your question when we present the course. In the event that your question comes in too late for that, we'll give you a supplement, but we promise to address your question.
I think it's a very unique approach that we're attempting here, and you've presented it so beautifully. Thank you very much, because we've put so much effort into it, and we want to respond to the needs of individuals where they feel frustrated, they feel hopeless, they don't know where to turn. We believe that these courses and Rights University will provide hope and comfort and also a safety net for individual rights, your inalienable rights, and your sovereign citizen rights. And Joe has worked so hard with me on this, and we're very excited to bring it to you.
Well, Joyce, Joe, just as you mentioned, this has been a strong effort from both of us. The program itself, as we're putting it together for these master courses that are going to be offered through Rights University, and right now, as you mentioned, it's available on rightsradio.com. But we have put a lot of effort into this, and we have brought in some really respected people in their fields that are going to be presenting these courses. And I think that we need to let the listening audience know that, yes, these are serious courses, and they're presented by knowledgeable and noted experts in their fields.
And also, these are only the first five. We're coming online with many more. There'll be new courses every month, but this is a start. So visit rightsradio.com to see what we're offering and let us know what types of courses you'd like to see us offer in the future. Now, we have just a few minutes left, about 5 or 6 minutes. So, Joe, I think we should come back to the banking issue, because I have a very, very strong question for you, and that is, how is it possible that banks today, after all we've been through, the larger banks in particular, have more money than they did before the crisis? They're flush with our cash.
That is probably the single strongest statement we can make about them today. They are. They're flush with more cash than they've ever seen in the history of the banking industry. most of it has come from us. If they've participated in the bailout, they've collected millions and billions of dollars. A lot of that money has basically been given to them with no strings attached. As it stands right now, we're seeing that the Congress is trying to rewrite some of the rules of the bailout money to make the banks accountable for it. And in those instances where they are starting to put conditions on it, we see a lot of the banks are giving the money back. But once again, all we can say about it is we're dealing with bankers, we're dealing with the banking industry, and it's all about the money. When we follow the money, we'll see how the money's being used. Banks are not as transparent as they need to be. A lot of locally based banks, and even some of the national banks, are very strongly consumer-oriented. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to try to take your money in the form of an overdraft protection. That doesn't mean that they're not going to try to take all of our money by participating in the bailout package. These are bankers, and bankers are greedy by nature. But the point is, for those banks that are consumer-oriented, if a customer, a consumer, runs into an issue of an unfair overdraft or an overdraft that they feel should not have been applied to their account, the best recourse is to talk directly to the bank, voice your outrage over it. Let the bank know you're unhappy. Most cases, if it's presented well, not from a screaming and irate standpoint, but you can make your point known and just let them know that you're irate over it. In most cases, the bank will refund all the charges, which is what...
Who should they talk to? To the manager of the bank?
The branch manager is usually the person who has the authority to take care of that. That's who I suggest they talk with. Along the way, it's also helpful if the person visits the bank on a fairly regular basis. Even though I do most of my banking online, I make it a point to get inside my bank every now and then so that I'm a familiar face. I don't necessarily know the manager by name, but they know my face when I come in the bank. And they
know
that
I'm a very good point. Yeah, that's really a good point, to be seen there, because I know I had an encounter recently where a new and very young clerk started grilling me mercilessly. And I looked at her and I said, "What are you doing?" And, of course, she didn't recognize me, but that's because she was new. But if I were a phantom at that bank, of course she wouldn't have recognized me, and you can get into a lot of problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just the fact that you show up from time to time, there are going to be some people in the bank that know your face. They recognize you. It doesn't hurt to introduce yourself as you're doing business with them if you're transacting business. I've done that with every bank that I've ever dealt with, and it's never failed to produce good results.
Well, this has been so eye-opening, both on the banking front, and of course I'm thrilled that you were able to share our plans for Rights University. We hope that more of those banks will give back the money, but P.S., I'd like to say while they were holding on to it, those who do intend to give it back, I'm sure they were using it and making money off the money that we gave them, however briefly, wouldn't you say?
I would say so. If somebody mistakenly gave me $100 billion tonight and I had to give it back tomorrow afternoon, I would be more than happy to do so after drawing 24 hours worth of interest on the money.
Okay. Well, Joe, now we've come to the end of our wonderful show, and I want to thank you again for joining me as my co-host today. And this is Dr. Joyce Starr with Rights Radio, rightsradio.com, and Rights University. And we will see you next week at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Bye-bye.